This is CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com, just after 7 o'clock on the 16th of April. A couple of things that are going on in the world that we've already referred to, Notre Dame Cathedral. A couple of things that have been pouring in about driving, because we had Pig Spotter here, and even the AA saying in the headlines earlier that the price of petrol is going to go up again.
Mm.
Get ready.
People are being very vigilant now when it comes to the lotto, I've noticed.
Oh, really?
Because of that guy who took so long to claim his money.
Oh, yes?
As soon as, I mean, the news flashes go, daily lotto results are out. And then 2 seconds later, one person wins 416,000. Everyone's like really checking their tickets now.
Mm, I'd love to win some serious money in the lotto, but it'll never happen. It's a stupid thing. And you're not going to win. So, I mean, unless you're doing it purely for fun, having what the old people used to call a flutter,
yes.
Otherwise don't bother.
Don't rely on it.
If you're actually relying on it, I mean, they've proven in America that the people who spend the most on the lotto are the people who can least afford it. And
yeah.
A lot of poor people in America are spending, like I'm talking about very poor people, people on food stamps, are spending up to a quarter of their money on lotto tickets.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's the same with gambling.
So stupid.
Scratch cards and things like that.
Yeah. All right, there's lots of stuff to get into today. I got a message here from somebody who says, Gareth, Anthea was fooling you yesterday. If anything declines by 100%, it becomes zero. So she said there was a question of 990% decline, which would make something worth negative 890 Rand. We were talking about the price of a share. So what I think she meant is that if you take the current price of the share and you work it backwards to what the share was at its most valuable, then you do have a percentage increase of 890% there. Or 900, now I can't remember the number. I think 980%. So if your eventual number is, let's say, 5 cents for the share, and previously it was worth, let's say, 1,000 Rand, then you can say that it has declined by 890%. Looking backwards, of course, you're absolutely right. You can't take more than 100% of something away without it being less than zero. So I do understand what you mean. But I think she's working it the other way around. So imagine you could look back from the future and you would see that the share price is now much, much less than it was at its peak. That's the kind of differential she's trying to show. And
right.
I'm no mathematician, but I get that.
Yeah.
All right. Kurt Darren has badly... This is very important. I do love this. He's been ripped for badly singing the national anthem at the Varsity Cup last night.
I hate these things. They make me feel so awkward.
Fantastic. All right. So here it is. Here's, here's Kurt Darren butchering the anthem. Let's go, Kurt. Take it away. Oh, I love this. Go on. Nice and loud. Oh. And even the players look confused. Let's just go back and enjoy this one more time. All right, take it away, Kurt. Man. Okay, so he lost his way, clearly, because it's Morina Buluga Sechava Saisu, Ofe Dise Dintwa Nimatswe.
Swe, hey,
so he just dropped that out. He just left that alone, right?
Oh, you know what?
Because remember, Art Matthews is still trying to get
out.
I know. There's that. And then there was also
Rastumisani. People do not forgive these guys. Rastumisani has never got a gig since then. Art Matthews is struggling. Oh, shame.
All you have to do is Google Rastumi, even D-U, and it just auto-completes to Rastumisani National Anthem Fail.
Let's remind ourselves. Come on, I want to hear it again.
I'm so embarrassed.
Why do you get embarrassed?
So
that's
awkward.
So weird.
Why is it awkward?
We feel so sorry for them.
Because this is...
It's never forgotten.
Here's Rastumisani. Let's listen to him again. Oh, this is years ago.
First, it'll be the National Anthem of South Africa. Corsi Sicilieri Africa.
Corsi
the harmony.
And then Art Matthews ruining the national anthem. This is great.
No.
I love it.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, as we wrap it up, Art Matthews.
Kosi Sikelele, Africa.
Malumakani
Swift.
Oh, yeah, Jesus.
Me, Scoozy. I'm so nervous. This is such a big honor for me.
Okay.
Malumakani Swift.
Oh,
my. Oh, my hands are sweating.
Oh, Jesus.
Izwe mitanda zoyetu.
Oh, wait, I think was Art playing the guitar?
Yes.
That's what makes it worse. You could have taken a beat and then started strumming again perfectly.
He forgot the words.
He wasn't even syncing up with his own guitar playing. Yeah. Oh, Art, that's so bad.
Anyway, good for them. There's another name to add to the list, Kurt Darren.
Kurt, at least you can say, like, okay, yeah, the backing track moved too fast for him and he lost his way.
No!
I don't know, something.
But you know
this
happens. I mean, in America, it's also happened. Right?
Yeah, the Super Bowl songs as well.
Because people get so nervous about the anthem because it has so much
Fergie
weight.
Fergie did it.
And, yeah.
Oh, Fergie had that
really
iconic one.
She was screeching it.
Christina Aguilera has ruined it.
Let's listen to Fergie again. That was a good one.
Oh, sir, yes. Can you see by the dawn's early light?
It's like a sexy version.
What's so proudly waved at the
if y'all say I can't sing and you consider this singing.
But surely there were practice rounds. Didn't someone say to her, Angie Foot?
That was horrible. Okay, but that wasn't as bad. The best one of all time was Roseanne.
Remember that.
Do you remember Roseanne? So Roseanne thought this was hilarious at the time. I mean, she really just doesn't. She's never cared about what people thought. But she went to 1990 and did this. It's beautiful. At the Jack Murphy Stadium.
When I should start.
Tell me when I should start. Yeah. That's already bad.
How say can you see?
Oh no.
Oh, it's just beautiful.
That's so bad.
So great.
Man.
All right, here's Christina Aguilera. Are we having fun with this?
Oh my God.
Okay, this they say is a good one. This is Kelly Clarkson. They like this. R. Kelly. That's R. Kelly just go.
Now, don't you think that's a good tactic? Actually, those three, Kelly Clarkson, Christina, and R. Kelly, that's a good tactic. Just sing the melody. Go ahead, just do these vocal things. Yeah. When you forget the words, what else can you do?
No, I think it's a very bad idea to just know that this is the one you've got to know, right? I mean, you're going to perform this, or else say no.
Honestly.
And again, there are rehearsals before.
Well, it doesn't always help. There's just, oh, there's such bad ones. There's such bad ones. Do you want to hear, here's a terrible one. Cat de Luna. Was so proudly we held at the last of a bursting in air. Oh,
yeah,
man,
the lyrics
so
there are bad.
Yeah, it's hard. Look, it's a hard song to sing. Taylor Swift?
But it's...
You want to hear her fuck it up? All right, listen to this. It's just bad. It's by no means as embarrassing as some of the ones we've heard.
I also don't think National Anthem is a song you can really do your own rendition of.
No, you just keep it as simple as possible. Yes. And also, look, I'll tell you what, that American anthem's very hard to sing. It crosses a huge
I've
range.
I've tried in the shower. It didn't go well.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh, I'd like to hear that.
Oh, no. In my mind, I sing like Whitney Houston did at the, was at the Olympics.
You're one of those people. You're one of those.
And the land of the free.
We just got a worse version.
And the... I'm sorry.
So, you know, the other day we were talking about how you could go to an Airbnb and they could be filming you.
Oh, these cams.
Yes.
Because people have these hidden cameras in
just in recently. Airbnbs.
So how can you find them if someone... does have a hidden camera in your Airbnb. Can you find it? Do you need like a fancy device?
There are devices, but start with the basics, using your eyes.
Thanks for that.
Wow, that's pretty simple.
Just keep your eyes open for any odd-looking gadgets in your Airbnb, like gadgets that look a little bit bulky or out of place. They might contain a hidden camera. Also, if you see one of these, you'll probably find that it has... a clear line of sight, so there are no objects in front of it, so kind of blocking it. That might be another way of seeing it. You need to look out for, and also let's understand that we're raising our level of paranoia here by 980%.
980%.
Yes.
Oh, that's an Anthem stat.
I mean, we're almost as paranoid as Sia in this situation, where we're now searching for cameras in our rooms, but you can usually find them. If they are there in an alarm clock, wall clock, smoke detectors, in the plants, behind the mirrors, in light bulbs, in speakers, and even USB wall plugs. So if you see a USB wall plug that you don't know what it's for, unplug it. There's also a way, if you turn off all the lights in your room and you use your smartphone's torch, you might see a reflection because the lens is usually behind glass.
That's clever.
Yes. So there's that. You can also use these Wi-Fi sniffing apps. So there's an app, for example, called Fling, which displays all the wireless devices connected to a Wi-Fi network.
Yeah.
So you can try one of those sometimes.
Because you see, they make these cameras really small.
That's the thing.
And they're not connected necessarily to a wire, so they often are wireless themselves. They just beam it back to whatever their server is.
I mean, in the one Airbnb incident with a camera recently in New Zealand, they were actually live streaming the film. So that can happen too. And then if you want to get really fancy, you can carry around with you an RF detector. And that gives off, that picks up radio frequencies, which is what allows Wi-Fi and Bluetooth to exist, essentially. So, yeah, if you're really paranoid, get an RF detector.
No. See, this is, it's a sad state of living, really, to have when you now have to check into a place. And often if you're traveling for work and you're already grumpy and tired and you just want to have a shower and relax, and now you have to spend, what, a good 20 minutes snooping the room. Or what's going to happen? I was thinking about it as we were discussing it last week on the show. I thought, okay, do you now have a way to legally cover yourself if you're checking in? Do you have to blatantly ask the people, do you have anything recording me in the room? And you have to record that conversation with them.
I would, you know, I would just use this, all of these incidents and kind of joke about it and say, you don't have any cameras, do you? You've heard all these Airbnb stories of cameras.
Well, now I know just not to do anything in a room that's not my own. Just literally sleep, wake up, shower, get out of there. I'm not doing anything.
And then you find out that the shower's even got one in.
But you know, rather leak a video of me in the shower than leak a picture of me with my fetish of dressing up as a pet pig.
With your and a array of butt plugs that you pull out of your suitcase and line them up on the dressing table.
Imagine. Nope, not.
Very good. Okay.
So rather let's cry about that than something weird coming out. Mm. Well, Gareth, here's something interesting. You've alluded to things like these a couple of times over the show in the past before, and it's the number of super rich people who leave the country.
Yeah, this is what really worries Cyril. This is what keeps him up at night, because these are the people who are paying taxes who are going to find somewhere else to pay tax because they're sick to death of being ripped off by this government.
And these are people who go, well, if things don't shape up, we dust our hands and we leave.
Yeah.
So there's a company called New World Wealth who's done research over this over the past couple of years. And they have released yesterday that in the past 10 years, South Africa has had 3,000 super rich people leave the country.
Sure.
And by super rich, their definition is people who have a wealth of over $1 million. So that's 14 million rands. And most of them went either to the UK, Australia, the US. Switzerland and Portugal are also popular destinations for them to migrate to. And their definition of migration is those who have left and are now living in a new country for more than half the year. And as much as you've brought this up as well, Gareth, it's most of these people actually leave and they say they are looking for places that have low tax rates when compared to the rest of Africa.
Well, you see, this is what also I've got to remind socialists and people who think that they're entitled to other people's money, thieves basically. I've got to remind you that if you are clever enough to have made a couple of million rand, you're probably clever enough to know where to go to keep your couple of million rand. And you don't always want to be part of a country that wants to steal that from you. That is obvious. You're not going to keep those people. You can't chain them, like Cyril says, to a tree. It's a bad idea to go after money that isn't yours if you're a government, because what's going to happen is ultimately you'll chase away the productive people. Guess what you'll be left with? A bunch of people who can't make money, who need the money to be paid to them.
What
so you
mess.
End up with a drain on society. It's unsustainable. It's a very bad idea, and it's obviously not going to work, guys. Get with it.
Yeah, and this just shows a whole chain reaction of things. So if you look at South Africa's wealth overall, 42% of our wealth is held in these high net worth individuals. So if they now start moving, you go, oh, okay, what's going to happen to us? And some of the findings that have come out of this,
by the way, these are the people who pay for the roads to be done and for the
RDP housing.
Yeah. Everything that you say you need and that Cyril promised in Alex the other day, it's not him paying for that. He doesn't have Cyril doesn't make money. All right, and he might in his personal capacity, but his government certainly aren't a money generator. They're a money user.
Right. This is, I think, a very relevant and important gauge on the South African economy. So this company who did the study, New World Wealth, also says that something like this just shows that if South Africa's losing a large number of these high net worth individuals to migration, it's probably due to serious problems in the country. Well, obvious. They list crime, lack of business opportunities, and religious tensions as some of the major causes. I'm stunned by religious tensions in South Africa.
Yeah, I mean there are always religious tensions. It's maybe not as apparent and obvious, but it could have to do with, you know, the biggest hate crime statistic in America is against Jews. for example. Nobody talks about that. People talk about hate crime in America, and you assume it's race stuff.
Mm.
You know, not fake race stuff like Jussie Smollett's thing, but that people would be. There are very few racist hate crimes in America. Very few. It's at low, low levels, right? Most of the hate crime in America, according to all the statistical databases that we can access, are against the largest proportion of them, the majority of them by far, against Jews. So that could account in this country for a similar statistic.
Yikes. Yeah, I don't mean to sound all doom and gloomy, but the report concludes by saying that this is a sign of some bad things to come, as high net worth individuals are often the first people to leave since they have the means to leave.
Yeah, they can leave, yeah. You see.
We hope it doesn't get to that point, but this is something we should be paying attention to, definitely.
Yeah. Mm. All right, couple other fun things.
Yep. Now,
this seems so obvious, but how you transform your smartphone into a mini TV, Leanne has, either she's just worked out that you turn it
no.
to landscape mode.
No, it's the size. It's got to do with the size. Oh. So, I mean, I'm doing it myself. I now watch DSTV on my phone.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit frustrating not having a big screen. Also, sitting with your big fat laptop on your lap in bed is not nice either.
And the worst is an iPad. It just falls onto your face and
exactly.
But also so even with your laptop, if you're binge-watching something in bed and you want to get comfortable, you never really find the perfect position because you want to lie down and now you're horizontal and then you flip your laptop over. Yes. But it's just not the same.
No.
It doesn't cut it.
So there's actually a really cheap solution, well, relatively. You don't have to buy a screen or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
You get this mount. It's made of wood. It's really light. You put your phone on it, and it magnifies your phone onto a bigger screen in front of it.
Oh, okay.
And it's only like $15.
Okay.
You can get two for 30.
A couple hundred bucks.
Yeah. All it's right. really not bad at all. So I was quite pleased to find that. And you know, obviously searching online, you'll be able to find it. It's called Screen Magnifying Smartphone Mount, if you do want to have a look. And they come in gold, white, or coffee color.
Okay,
very I'm going to be getting one, definitely.
Now, apparently Zahara, who we haven't heard from in a long time, apparently Zahara is a bit of a puzza face. They've been telling her that if she doesn't stop drinking, she could die.
Well, I didn't actually know this, but she was diagnosed with liver failure in December.
Oh, my God.
So she's actually at the point of near death already.
Good Lord.
Apparently she has been drinking to cover up a lot of stuff that's been going on in her life. Betrayal, pressure, frustration. She had some run-ins with a record company as well. But apparently her doctors have said if she continues drinking, she's going to die. And apparently that news in itself broke her, and she turned back to drinking again, though she was told that her liver had been badly damaged already. Mm. So, yeah, that's not really a nice story to hear. I mean, when she was first such a big sensation when she first hit the scene.
Yeah.
And she just seemed more of a sort of respectful person than a lot of people who are on the music scene at the time.
But I have a bit of an objection to this. Zahara should have clarified her comments when she first started speaking about this, because I felt personally attacked. Last week she said, "I realized I had a drinking problem when I finished a bottle of wine on my own." I thought,
about that.
Well, so
I'm sitting in the studio with two people who have no problem polishing off a bottle of wine.
Yeah, I thought that was the dosage size.
Yeah, but a bottle of wine is like, what, 4.5 glasses?
4 glasses. Yeah.
Oh, you could finish that in the course of...
No, exactly.
2 hours.
But she's obviously drinking more than that for her liver to be in such a state.
Yeah, she should have flat out said, "I have health issues."
Yeah.
Don't bring the beer.
And it's the frequency of it. You know, if you're doing it every single night or whatever, it definitely takes its toll.
Leanne, how long does it take for you to polish off a bottle?
If I'm pissed off at someone, it can happen very quickly. And that's her problem. She's she's pissed off with people. She left TS Records, who don't exist anymore, by the way. She had a big fight with them. There were money demands and contracts that were due that were never delivered. So, yeah, she's definitely angry at someone.
How do you know you're an alcoholic, though? I mean, how would you say you've got a problem? I'm not being sarcastic and silly now. Like, how would you know if you have a problem?
I think when it starts affecting your day-to-day life and your work, if you're missing deadlines, if you aren't pitching up for family dinners because of drinking, I think when it starts to have an impact on your day-to-day life, that's when I think it's a problem.
Okay, so you see, I always used to think if I go home every day and I drink, I mean, I suppose my grandparents' generation, they used to go home after a hard day's work and have a whiskey,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I suppose for a lot of people to go home and have a glass of wine is part of how they end the day. So I suppose that's okay. I don't ever drink on my own.
Mm.
So I suppose that's how I will know if I've gone beyond a point.
Yeah.
If I start getting home and drinking on my own, which I've never wanted to do. For me, drinking is a social thing. So that's my line. For you, it's if you start missing important things and it starts to control your life. And another
measurement for me is, and where I have to watch myself, is if I'm feeling depressed or angry about a situation or upset or stressed because of too much work, being able to cope without alcohol is a good measurement there as well.
Okay.
Wait, but...
How would you know, Sia?
You see, I'm trying to figure that out in my head, and the most simplest way I think I can explain it is if there's a dependency to it. I think there's nothing bad if you're upset, and you're frustrated, and you're like, ugh, you know what, let me just have a drink. Because, yeah, we know drinking makes us feel better, makes us more relaxed or calm down. But if it's like a proper depression,
mm.
and you're depending on alcohol to pull through, that I think is a problem.
Yeah.
Because I'll frankly admit, alcohol is my vice. It is not something I'm dependent on. I'm not addicted to it, but it is my vice. And best believe, there's a drink for any time of the day. And it's a vice by the means that I love going home and having some type of drink, whether it's a gin and tonic, whether it's a glass of wine, whether now it's a beer. But I just feel like it's now part of my afternoon process.
Okay.
I get home, I answer a few emails, I will...
Oh, is that why your emails are so friendly after a certain time?
Hey, G.
I answer a few emails, I take a bath, I get into a robe, and then I select a drink to drink while I catch up on TV or I now chat to friends. It's just part of my process. The fact that I drink, you know, every afternoon or every 2 days, I don't think I'm an alcoholic, though.
Mm. You know what? There are so many YouTube videos and YouTube channels that you can subscribe to as well. With, you know, I think probably the best thing to do is to listen to a person who is an alcoholic, and they can tell you.
Mm.
And if you search or Google these videos, you'll see so many of them. I watched a TED talk as well quite recently of a woman who was talking about alcoholism. So I think it's a lot to do with other people's experiences who are alcoholics. That's how you would know.
All right. Well, there we go. Thanks, Sahara, for getting us into that depressing thought.
Yeah, goodness.
But shame. She might not make it, huh? They say she could die if she doesn't stop drinking.
Yeah.
Listen, eventually your liver gives in. Just ask former Minister Manto Shabalala Msimang.
Oof. Oy vey.
She went through.
All that garlic didn't help.
Not a chance. All right.
Here's something interesting as well. Mm-hmm. We all want success, right? We all
Damn
want
right.
success yes,
course,
and money.
Yeah.
Yes. But when we find out the truth behind what it takes to receive that level or success, yeah, things get a little tricky. Last week, Jack Ma, Alibaba,
mm-hmm.
huge, huge rich man, and China's richest man, actually,
yes.
said something very candid around what it takes to achieve his level of success and wealth. And he says for himself, and for his Alibaba employees, he expects them to work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And he says that is the only way his company has been able to get to the point that it has.
Sure.
He says this last week. Now the world is at a, having a huff and a puff about like, oh my goodness, no, you can't say that. You need to care about people and you need to sympathize and you know, what about your employees' well-being? And now he's come out again this week. People were expecting him to apologize and he said very frankly, nope.
Yeah.
I'm standing by this. If you really want to achieve the levels of success that we have, the means and the way in which we've gone about it is working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. So he says, as I expected, my comments internally a few days ago caused a debate and nonstop criticism. He says, I understand these people and I could have said something that was, in inverted commas, correct. But we don't lack people saying correct things in the world today. What we lack is truthful words that make people think.
I mean, if that's, those are the facts. He's just giving the facts.
Yeah.
He's not trying to influence people or change the way they do things. Somebody asked him and he's answered.
Yeah, he's not trying to make a statement about how you should live your life. If you want to be as rich as Jack Ma, he says, I get asked all the time by people, how am I so rich? This is how. Mm. 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And you know what? If you think you're going to get rich on 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, forget about it.
You just can't get around working hard.
Right.
So for him and a lot of Alibaba employees, they get to work at 9 a.m. and they leave at 9 p.m.
You know what? A lot of us.
I can't.
No. I did it for years. For 16 years, I worked 13 hours a day.
There we go.
Six to seven times a week.
Why aren't you made of Jack Ma money?
Yeah.
Huh?
No.
What's up with you?
And I think a lot of people don't realize how much they work, especially now with having your laptop at home or your phone, and you're putting in the hours at the office, but you're also putting in hours after that. And a lot of people are working 12-hour days without even realizing it.
Mm. And he says, just in clarifying, though, he says he doesn't force all of his employees to work these 12 hours because, yes, he does note that that would be inhumane to a certain extent. But this is what I love. He says, he would never force staff to work a 9-9-6. That's the 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. schedule. But he says people who slack off were not considered his brothers. I mean, what sort of guilt trip thing is that? Like, it's fine, you can leave the office.
I'm not forcing you.
But just know you are my brother.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I get it. It's hard work and that's what it takes. Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not ready for that, though.
So there's a new breed or a new, what do you call it, of a plant species?
Yeah.
Of banana called Blue Java. And they're called Blue Java because they're actually quite bluey green in appearance. Not like an unripe banana, but they've actually got like a blue tinge. And apparently it tastes just like ice cream.
Oh, really?
That must be amazing. So,
Leanne, do you need a moment?
I love bananas as it is. I know a lot of people actually feel indifferent to bananas.
I like bananas, yeah.
But a lot of banana enthusiasts in recent years, believe me that they exist, have found that the bananas lately have been a little bit bland. Have you found that?
Bananas are bland. I mean, apparently banana is the only thing that you can eat, only that, and you'll survive.
Like, oh, really?
I've told you this before. Yeah, if you were on a desert island, because bananas have, critically, they have potassium in them. And you need that very bad.
Very good for you if you've been been struck by lightning as well, and you survived.
How do you guys know this?
I know because I know someone who was struck by lightning
and ate
a shitload of bananas, and that really brings up.
You
the
know
potassium
some interesting
levels.
People who've been struck by lightning.
Yeah, he was leaning on a.
Don't laugh when you're about to retell this.
He was leaning on the aluminium sink in the kitchen with his hands, looking out at the sky and saying, oh, we've got quite a storm coming in. And the lightning hit the aluminium sink and he was flung back. But anyway, so
he survived.
So he eat bananas.
What happened to him? Did he?
No, he survived. He was
no horrible damage.
Fine, and he credits all of his recovery to eating lots of bananas. He's a veterinary practitioner.
So this banana, this blue Java, tastes like ice cream.
Mm. And you can actually buy the seeds online and grow your own.
Hmm.
So that's what I'm thinking.
All right.
I might, or we can grow one here, a blue Java banana tree.
All right. A couple of people who want to reply to some of the things that have been going on. First of all, Jack Black singing the national anthem was phenomenal. Whitney did one of the best, says someone else. If I rent an Airbnb, says Robert, I'm going to walk around with my dick out. It's the benefit of these places. If the owner wants to see it, I have no issue.
If he wants a show, give him a show.
Right. Cindy says, I'm about to fly to New York. I'm now downloading these sniffer apps. I'm going to be trying all these tricks in my new hotel to check for cameras.
Oh.
I mean, who says it's only Airbnbs?
No, exactly.
Good point. G-Man says, are you guys following the lawsuit that's being brought against the Southern Poverty Law Center for falsely accusing conservatives of being Nazis and white supremacists? That bullshit organization is going down. Gavin McInnes is taking them out. Good for him.
Didn't know about that.
Southern Poverty Law Center is basically a bunch of crooked people who go around calling everybody else Nazis and trying to blanket conservatives as hostile right-wingers. And they've now been exposed for the bullshit organization that they are. Someone else says, if you aren't sure whether you're an alcoholic or not, you're an alcoholic if you cannot not have that drink. Doesn't matter if you only have one glass of wine a day. If you cannot skip a day, then you have a problem. That's from D.
Did you know that some people are alcoholics and they've never had a sip of alcohol in their lives? When you look at alcoholism as a genetic disease, there are some people who are born alcoholics, but let's say they live in a society where drinking is not permitted, maybe because of their religion, maybe culturally, or maybe they just don't have access to money to buy alcohol. You get people who are born and die alcoholics without never having had a sip of alcohol.
Good Lord.
Oh.
Mm.
That I did not.
That's interesting. Yeah, I forgot about that one.
Yeah, bring that one up. Okay. Yeah. All right, we've got to get to Blind History.
Very good.
Today's episode of Blind History is Joan of Arc, and we're going to talk about her because she's a – I mean, it's more appropriate than ever with this fire in Notre Dame Cathedral, which is obviously the place where she was canonized as a saint. She was variously called the Maid of Orléans as Saint Joan, Jeanne de France. She apparently was burnt at the stake. Well, not apparently. She was ultimately burnt at the stake, condemned by her enemies as a heretic and a lunatic. She died before her 20th birthday. But in that short life, she succeeded in bringing France together, beating back the English, and securing her young king on the throne. It is the latest in our episodes of Blind History for this Tuesday morning, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters, for your edification and pleasure. All of her life, she'd had visions and claimed to speak directly to God. A young farm girl of piety and faith. She even broke the rules. She became a warrior for France, only to have people who had praised her eventually turn on her. In a time of peril and danger, of war and superstition, poor little Joan of Arc, at the age of only 19, was burnt at the stake as a heretic, sacrificing her own life to the flames of the pyre. This is Blind History, where we unpack some of the most well-known people from history, some of the people who made the world what it is today. And I am with Anthony Medera, and we're talking Joan of Arc. So we go from one saint to another. Both of these women had to wait until after they were dead to be proclaimed saints, which usually happens, but the stories are very different. Joan of Arc was very young when she died, and in those short years that she was alive, she made enormous political difference in Europe. She got herself involved in the Hundred Years' War between France and England in a very, very powerful way, and became the savior of not only the monarch in France, who was a weak king, but also of France itself. She saved them from complete conquest by King Henry V of England.
I'm absolutely blown away by Joan. I mean, she died at 19, and the fact that who's going to believe a 16-year-old?
Who was illiterate?
100% illiterate. Couldn't ride a horse, couldn't write.
She could barely plant a few veggies.
Yeah. And you know, the facts are all there. She was there at the coronation of Charles VII. It's just incredible. Wow. But maybe just to paint the picture briefly, the Hundred Year War started with Edward III because there's a long history of the English and the French, and in terms of the English having right to France or parts of France. And Edward wanted France. And ultimately, that started the Hundred Year War. And she was fundamentally part, definitely the start of the ending of that Hundred Year War. It probably pinnacled with Henry V.
Now, you love Henry V.
I do,
yes. He's one of your favorite kings.
Yeah.
Do you want to just quickly tell us, as part of her story, a little bit about him?
So Henry V, he made a treaty. Yes, the current king, he suffered from dementia, Charles VI, the French. Mm-hmm. The French king.
They weren't a very strong line genetically, the Valois branch of the French monarchy. They were mostly very inbred. They had trouble fathering sons. There were lots of very bad marriages within the family, so there was inbreeding. They were crook-backed and had bad jaws and bad teeth, and they were generally quite feeble-minded. Some of them went mad. Some of them were just very, very slow.
Yeah.
Not a great line. And it's no doubt that, it was to France's advantage that they died out shortly after this period of history, because then the Bourbon dynasty took over. And from there, we had the great French kings of the 15, 16, and 1700s.
But Henry, who was actually a very, very strong king, you know, there's a lot of talk about his young life when he was a prince, et cetera, and a playboy. But ultimately, when he became king, he put his head down. He was a warrior king. And he won quite a few battles against the French. And suddenly they realized, especially King Charles VI, that this guy is strong. And he just buckled. Ultimately, in the end, there was a treaty where Henry, they would leave Charles VI as in the King of France in name only. And then ultimately,
Henry's son would accede to both. Thrones,
correct.
France and England.
And it was his daughter, Charles VI's daughter was married to Henry.
That's right.
So that was his grandchild, basically. Henry's also was descendant from Edward III, so there was a good lineage there. So that's basically what happened. So Henry got what Edward III really wanted, control and king of England and France. And this is where Joan came in.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Henry also didn't last a very long time. And when his son came to the throne of both France and England, supposedly, he was too young to really be able to imprint any authority on that. And as a result, the whole dream of a united France and England fell apart shortly after. But it was through no fault of Henry V's that happened.
Yeah.
And Joan of Arc was born into this world where there was a contestation of thrones, where there was huge uproar over religious heresy. There were some very evil people in the world of religion at that time who were starting inquisitions, who were calling people heretics, burning witches. It was really an awful time for religion. Suspicion everywhere. Not a great period in terms of anyone being proud of themselves.
But I think that's probably why some people believed her, because there was a massive amount of superstition. And she could have been schizophrenic, or she could have been bipolar, and she's talking to herself, you know, with the visions. And a lot of the things that she said predicted, supposedly, came true. So in the end, they actually started to take her seriously. And this led her to the prince, who was Charles VI, he died, but Charles VII, who was the prince, the Dauphin, yeah, he actually gave her an audience. This particular generation was, you know, I don't know a lot about his dad, but this guy was yellow. I mean, my goodness. I mean, what she, this poor peasant girl, did for him to get him into power, he never backed her.
She was present at his coronation. And in fact, for a while, he took her very seriously and took her advice and owed a lot of his authority to her. And there were a lot of people in France who had very little to look forward to without Joan of Arc. And because she was such a woman of inspiration and she believed so devoutly that God was on her side, she managed to infuse in the ordinary French soldiery a huge amount of devotion and I suppose you could call it acclaim. And she was present when they conducted the siege of Orléans, which was probably her greatest victory. And she was successful over the English at that point. But it didn't take long for them to turn on her, because the French nobles were already factionalized. There were two or three different groups of French nobles, some who supported the king, some who supported Joan, some who were quite favorable to the English. And the one faction, the Burgundian faction, allied with the English and captured her. at Compiègne, and they handed her over to the English. And this was really the beginning of the end for poor Joan, because she was put on trial by a bishop called Pierre Cochon, who was an awful man, like Torquemada of the Spanish Inquisition. He declared her guilty of heresy. He said that she had claimed to be speaking to God, but it was actually the devil. And this girl, who was really not well-versed in literature, who was unable to really express herself the way that a learned bishop was, had no means of retaliating. She had no means of explaining what was going on. And he sketched the picture either that she was mentally ill and that she was obviously corrupted or possessed by demons, or that she'd actually been in league with Satan and knew that she was a bad person and was doing this as a conscious fraud. Horrible.
Yeah, he was terrible. He was proper a devil in a bishop's coat.
And then obviously she was very quickly declared a heretic and burnt at the stake, which is a horrible way to die. I mean, apparently what happens, and this was in the year 1431, and you can imagine a teenage girl being tied to a pole, like a gum pole, and all around her feet are arranged these what they called faggots of sticks, dry timber. And then these are lit, and they start to burn you from the feet up. But you actually don't die from the burning, painful as it is. You die from the asphyxiation from the smoke. And then, of course, the fire consumes you. Horrible.
And she asked for a cross, and there wasn't a cross around, so they gave her two sticks that she made a cross out of it. And people were so taken back by when she was burnt. There were a lot of people screaming in the crowds, "You just killed a saint." It was a terrible time. And what an incredible journey she'd had up until that point. I try to imagine, to think, suddenly she learns to ride a horse. Mm-hmm. This is right in the very beginning when Charles said, the Dauphin said, "Okay, so I'm listening to you." She learned to ride a horse, and she basically led the army.
Mm-hmm. As a woman. Can you imagine in those days, in armor?
In armor. And what the English used to do was they would starve their enemies. So in other words, the enemy or whatever it might be would stay in the village, and the village had a moat around it and was protected. And then the English would just wait. They'd set up camp, could be months. And then they'd run out of food. They start eating. They were eating rats. They were eating horses. They were eating cats. And the English were asleep. She managed to get into, with 200 of her soldiers, get into Orléans, and with food and more livestock. I don't know what the English were doing.
They must have been fast asleep.
They must have been. And then she screamed over the wall, "Hey!" Because she always had quite a vicious temper. And then she always used to swear at them and tell them that she's going to take France from them. And then they would say back to her, "I'm going to burn you at the stake." And she was a strong, strong character. And also during the trial, let's go across to the trial before with this horrible bishop.
Yes.
He thought, "This is going to be a joke. You know, I'm this learned bishop. And this is a peasant girl. She can't even sign her name." And she was so strong in her defense and unwavering. And whenever you try to trick her, without any education, she knew how to answer it.
Well, I mean, she was eventually debunked of those charges. She was pronounced innocent, but this is unfortunately long after she was dead. She was declared a martyr, and she became a symbol of the Catholic League, declared a national symbol of France by Napoleon. She was beatified and canonized in the 1900s, and she's now one of 9 secondary patron saints of France. So she has remained a popular figure in literature, in painting and sculpture and other cultural works since that very ugly death of hers. And many famous writers, playwrights, filmmakers, artists and composers have created and continue to create cultural depictions of her. We don't know how she actually looked. There are very few contemporary pictures of Joan of Arc. And they haven't found any real relics of hers. And you know how the Catholic Church loves to collect relics. But apparently there's a ring that they found. It was believed to have been worn by Joan, and it passed through the hands of several prominent people, including a cardinal, a king, and the daughter of a British physician, and apparently it was sold at an auction to a theme park in, I think it was the early 1970s, for £300,000. Now, there's no conclusive proof that she owned the ring, but it's an unusual design, and it matches her own words about her ring at the trial. And the Arts Council later determined that that ring should not have left the United Kingdom. The purchasers appealed, including the Queen of England, that the ring should be allowed to remain in France. And it has reportedly been passed along to some other people since then, but came from Cardinal Henry Beaufort, who was actually at the trial and execution in 1431. So there's something interesting.
That is very, very interesting. So there's some relic left.
Well, they did also find remains that are supposed to have been from under the funeral pyre, a charred human rib, carbonized wood, and a piece of linen and a femur of a cat, which is explained obviously by the fact that they used to burn cats with witches because cats were their familiars, right? But they actually did forensic research on this stuff, and they found actually that those relics came from an Egyptian mummy in the 6th or 3rd century BC, and the charred appearance was the result of embalming substances, not from combustion. And they decided, no, these were completely fake. So they have been, I suppose, outed as hoaxes. But there's no actual physical evidence of Joan, but we know that she had to have existed. And, of course, the French crown was saved by her, so we know that politically she had enormous influence too.
Oh, there was definitely massive influence. I don't know, Gareth, 6 years?
You know, what's interesting about Joan, and I suppose some of the other women in this part of the series, is that you either are born to power, or you have power thrust upon you, or in the case of Joan, you rise to power through your own force of nature. And this woman had no advantage in her birth. She had no special skills or talents other than being fierce and absolutely devoted to God. And yet she rose to be effectively the leader of France in a time where there were only men, and in a time where if you weren't royal, you didn't have a hope in hell. And here she was, taking to the fore, taking to the battlefield, and as you say, just an unapologetic, strident, powerful, self sort of assured woman of great warrior potential, and someone who actually ended up fighting some of the greatest soldiers of her time.
And very charismatic. To be able to just come, pitch up and lead. I don't know what she was hearing. You know, she was hearing voices, etc., the saints.
Yeah, there's still people today are hearing things.
Yeah, she took that. She said, I've got to save this yellow-bellied prince.
Yeah.
So, you know, that part of the story, it doesn't wash with me. It's just they basically offered ransom. They said, look, we've captured her. You pay me for her. The English offered 10,000. I'm not sure what the currency was at the time, but they offered, which is a significant amount of money. The French offered 6,000, and the Dauphin offered zero.
So ungrateful.
Exactly, yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters.
This is CliffCentral.com.